This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The outcome of the 2020 presidential race is yet to be determined. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has a slim lead in the Electoral College over President Donald Trump, but a number of states, as we've just heard, are still counting ballots, and some will face recounts in the coming days. And there's a good chance that some of these results could be decided by the courts. We are live right now. It's a little after noon. It's possible we will get some additional results during this hour. So what's the outlook for this election? With us today on Vermont Edition are three people who've been following this race and the history of presidential politics very closely. Linda Fowler, who is a professor of government emerita at Dartmouth College, Matt Dickinson, a political science professor at Middlebury College, and also Ted Cohn, who is the chair of the College of Liberal Arts at Norwich University. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Vermont Edition. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Bob. Great to be with you, Bob. Yeah.
So let's see where we are right now, depending on if you count the Associated Press recognizing Arizona for Biden. Biden either has 264 electoral votes or 253. That would be minus Arizona. Trump at 214. The states everyone's watching today, Arizona, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Georgia, and perhaps North Carolina. Let me ask all of our guests today, what do you make of this current situation? It appears that a highly divided country just held an incredibly close and divided presidential race. What do you make of where we are right now? Linda?
Well, actually, I think we're right where we thought we would be, which is to say that there would be a lot of close states because both candidates were mobilizing new voters and that we wouldn't know the outcome for several days. And that's exactly what's happened. I think Democrats got misled by some of the trends that were showing up in the polls in October. I think they thought that senior citizens were going to be breaking for Biden more than they had in the past, that young people would be turning out, that non-college educated white women would be looked like they were turning away from Trump. So I think they were hoping for a blue wave, and that obviously didn't happen.
And Linda, do you think when you say the Democrats might have been misled by the information in the polls that they got in October, is this a case where the polls were just wrong again? They certainly were wrong in 2016. Are we seeing a replay of that this year?
I think the jury's still out because the votes are still being counted. But there's been some talk among pollsters, and I myself am not a pollster, so I'm not in a position. But again, the national polls seem to be quite accurate in terms of predicting the national popular vote. But it's the variation across the states that turns out to be quite problematic. And it's just hard with some of these states to get good poll information, I think.
Matt Dickinson, what do you make of where we are right now?
Well, like Linda, you know, the results, they were difficult to forecast in that the COVID epidemic upended our traditional understanding of electoral dynamics. So there's political science forecast models out there that are pretty accurate, that are sort of premised on certain economic fundamentals. And when those sort of go in the field, they sort of told us that Joe Biden was going to win this very comfortably. But then a lot of us were sort of saying, well, do those models hold up in a situation in which a lot of the economic dislocation is caused by bipartisan support for closing down sections of the economy? So I really, you know, in my public talks to students and in media, I said Joe Biden should win this popular vote, but I was not confident by the margin. So I can't say, I'm with Linda here, I can't say what we're seeing now is all that surprising, although if you look below the presidential level at the House races, I thought that was more surprising to me than what we're seeing at the presidential level. I just did not see the Democrats losing seats as it looks like they're going to in the House.
And Matt, that's pretty unusual for a party in power in a presidential year when their candidate appears to be doing pretty well for that party to lose seats, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what's happened here is they did so well in 2018 with a more limited turnout that some of those first-term incumbents with a broader turnout in 2020 were facing a little bit more moderate electorate, and they lost some seats there. But that's not the only thing that's going on. There must be some broader sentiments, and I'm curious, you know, to hear from Ted and Linda. I wonder if impeachment perhaps. There's a backlash there, but it does suggest that Biden's coattails were not nearly as strong as you might have thought.
Ted, what do you make of our situation?
Yeah, I mean, to echo, you know, what Matt was saying, I also think, you know, a lot of this has to do with the House votes. A lot of this has to be laid at the feet of Nancy Pelosi. You wonder if a stimulus bill, even though it was smaller than what the Democrats were looking for in the House, might have been a very powerful tool in the Democrats' pocket going into Election Day. But in general, on Tuesday night, I mean, I just had deja vu that it was back in 2016 again. And frankly, 2 days later, and even if Biden ends up winning, it's still going to seem a whole lot like 2016. And to echo what Linda was saying, you know, demographically, the Democrats should have these national elections in the bag, as Biden's 4 million lead in the popular vote indicates. And yet still, once again, the natural demographics of the Democratic Party, for the most part, didn't come into play. Bob, you and I have talked about the youth vote before. The youth vote was up, but it was up from 40% to 50%, which is, you know, still not a huge turnout, and the youth vote overwhelmingly favored Joe Biden. Biden, despite his huge war chest at the end, you know, he and the Democrats, because of the pandemic, as Matt was saying, kind of eschewed having any ground game like going door to door, like a neighborhood registration drive, something the Republicans and the Trump campaign did very, very well. So I wonder if this also affected what Matt was indicating as well, how the Biden coattails did not translate into larger wins in Congress for the Democrats.
Ted, I saw the pollster Frank Luntz on TV last night saying something that he's actually said for about the last week, and it's this. If Joe Biden loses, then political science pollsters should give up their jobs forever because they can't be relied upon to have any accurate results whatsoever. Ted, what do you think of that?
Yeah, but then what would, like, Matt, Linda, and I do for fun? You know, I mean, I'm sorry. If you're a political junkie, I mean, what did somebody say on the news recently? Don't get high on your own supply. But this, you know, this is what we do. This is the data that we have, the evidence that we have. As political scientists, as historians, how do you ignore the evidence that you have? Having said that, this data is very granular as well. It's not just about, you know, who are you voting for, Biden or Trump. It is about neighborhoods. It's about counties. It's about demographics. It's about what do you think about, you know, the second, third, and fourth issues about social justice in the country, economic inequality in the country. So I think political scientists and pollsters and all of us need to do a little bit better in how we collect the data. But at the end of the day, we still need this data, and we're still going to go to it.
Linda, we got this email from Chelsea in Burlington who wrote us, can you explain the potential election-related cases that might go to the U.S. Supreme Court and any insight on where Amy Coney Barrett stands on those issues? Let's just go first to the cases. What can you outline for us the kind of cases that would be eligible to go to the Supreme Court?
Well, to go to the court, you have to have evidence that rules were violated. I think that there's a lot of confusion about several issues that look like there might be rule violation that really are not. The first has to do with the fact that there's a disparity between what the registration votes showed on November 1 and what the actual number of votes cast was. That's because of same-day voting. And so a lot of people who registered to vote on the day that they voted were perfectly legal. And so to assert that there's some nefarious scheme underway is just represents a misunderstanding of why those numbers are working out that way. The other thing that I think people get confused about is when you have recounts. Recounts are simply to look for clerical and bureaucratic errors in terms of how the votes were tabulated. There's nothing nefarious that would send them into the courts. So what you're really looking at, if there are court cases, are where various state election boards might have violated their own rules. Remember, the Constitution gives the power to regulate elections to the states, not to the federal government. And so there's a huge variation in what states do. The issue that I think has been the most difficult for the public to understand is whether you stop counting votes on election day or you continue to count them. We've always had votes counted the day after and multiple days after that because many states don't allow the vote counting to begin until election day itself. So in New Hampshire, for example, where we had a lot of absentee ballots come in, they were opened to just check to see that everybody had followed the rules, but the ballot itself was the envelope was not open, and they couldn't start counting those till 7 o'clock. So there's some sense that same day voting is the valid total, but in fact, my ballot was sitting in the election office for about 3 weeks, and so it should not be considered to be a less valid ballot because I followed the rules and did absentee. So what you're really getting into are the weeds, and that is, what does the Constitution mean when it gives the power to the state legislatures to regulate elections? And this is primarily aimed at Pennsylvania, where the Republican state lawmakers have been filing multiple suits and arguing that their prerogatives as legislators has been violated by the state Supreme Court that allowed votes that were postmarked November 3rd could still be counted as late as, I think it's November 6th or maybe, no, I think it's 3 days. I'm not sure about that. In my view, the Supreme Court has already rejected those claims twice now, not with a formal hearing. There's some sentiment on the court that maybe the state court exceeded its bounds, but I'm not sure it's a majority opinion. The trick is that state legislatures establish procedures for the Secretary of State and election boards to follow. And unless there are procedural violations, it doesn't seem to me that the state's power the power of the state legislature has really been violated here. So I think there are a lot of claims. I think the multiplicity of them is to just muddy the water and create suspicion in the mind of the public. But so far, I haven't seen anything that looks like the courts would take it seriously.
And Linda, it's interesting you mentioned the experience in New Hampshire, quite different from that in Vermont, where about 85% of all voters cast their ballots using optical scan machines, and lawmakers told town clerks that they could start processing those ballots 30 days before the election, so there wasn't a huge crush on election day itself, and that's why some towns in Vermont were able to report sizable results not too late in the evening. Let's talk to Robert, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, Robert, welcome to the program.
Hi. So I got some information for you guys about how things are shaping up right at the moment. If Arizona is considered called for Biden, we know that he has 264 electoral votes, and all he needs is Nevada. and then that's all she wrote. He'll have 270. Right now, Nevada has increased from a lead of 8,000, which it was last night, to a lead of 11,500. Biden's vote lead is increasing as they are counting the votes in Nevada. Also, there's a guy named Rafael Irizarry, I can hardly pronounce the name, who is a statistician who's done some linear regressions on the Georgia vote and on the Pennsylvania vote. And on the Georgia vote, when there was 92% of the vote counted, Trump was ahead by 100,000, and when there was 95% of the vote counted, Trump was ahead by 50,000 or less than 50,000. And at around the projection then is when 97% of the vote in Georgia is counted, it'll even up. And when 100% of the vote is counted, Biden will be ahead by 50,000 votes in Georgia. That's what the linear regression says. Yes.
Okay. Robert, we appreciate your phone call. I think we all have to be really, really careful at this time of looking at different people, looking at different statistics, looking at different projections. It's just a matter of we don't know what's happening, and we have to be extremely careful until we get some final results in those states. I want to mention that President Trump's reelection campaign is filing a federal lawsuit in Nevada to ask for a temporary halt to the vote count there. It's the latest in a series of lawsuits the campaign has filed in key states still counting votes. So we'll get an update on that a little bit later in the program. Matt, let me ask you something. It could be a while after recounts and court challenges. It could be a while before we know who officially really won this race. What does that do to the psyche of the country?
Well, you saw by the previous caller, the partisans who were paying attention are going to be spending a lot of time trying to forecast the votes. And your caution is well taken. Just let the process unfold. We've had previous elections where it's typical for vote counting to take a long time. The problem is, in most previous elections, even though the vote counting was going on, we pretty much knew who was going to win. We don't know that now. And that allows, and again, I don't want to appear partisan here, but that allows particularly the Trump campaign to lay sow some doubt about the validity of that count for reasons that Linda, I think, so cogently stated, which people don't understand. Ballot counting in a state like Pennsylvania, in which postmarked ballots can come in after the election day and still count, those are real ballots. People aren't just manufacturing these after the election. They're just still coming in. And when you start raising questions, as the president did in the wee hours about I won and pointing to results that are preliminary results, it sows the seed of laying the groundwork for, frankly, spending the next 2 years claiming that Joe Biden was not legitimately elected. And to be perfectly objective and neutral, Democrats did something similar in 2016, spending 2 years talking about how the Russians elected Donald Trump, a slightly similar dynamic, different argument. But I just don't think it's good for democracy to have this type of questioning going on the basis of allegations of fraud or electoral procedures, violation of procedures, when there's no evidence that's happening.
And Ted, what about that? Is it possible here that folks are going to lose confidence in our democratic form of government? Is that the sort of the worst outcome that can happen?
I don't know if it's losing confidence. I mean, I think, you know, as a people, we're not a very patient people. We're an instant gratification society. We've been told for 4 years that there's going to be an election on Tuesday, and so we want the results. As Matt, Linda, and I have been talking in media and classrooms, the American electoral system is incredibly complicated. It's 50 state elections plus Washington, D.C., they all 50 plus one different sets of laws governing how you collect the ballots, how you count the ballots. And then on top of that, you add the layer of the Electoral College, which a lot of people find perpetually confusing. You know, again, Biden's ahead in the popular vote by 4 million. For a lot of Americans, why are we talking about this as being such a close election? I think the American electoral system is very, very complicated. And I think that's one of the things that turns off a lot of Americans from participating in the electoral process and voting. And so while we might be talking about this is the highest voter turnout in 120 years, I mean, we're still talking about one in three Americans did not vote, chose not to vote, couldn't be bothered to vote, or cast a kind of vote of dissatisfaction by not voting for one of the two major candidates. And so that is, to me, that continues to be discouraging about the American democratic process, that one in three Americans don't feel like they can participate or they don't want to participate in the system and sit out the election. What will it look like 4 years from now after the experience that we're all living through this very week? I think that is a question mark. Can you really get that two-thirds voter turnout again? Or are we going to sink back more to where we were in 2016 with about 60% of the vote coming out?
Well, let's go to our callers again and talk to Joe in St. Albans. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the program. Hi, Joe, you there?
Let's go to our callers again and talk to Joe.
How are you?
Are you there? Yeah. Joe, what's on your mind today?
Can you hear me?
We sure can.
I like most voters, like a determined outcome in a fair election. But a concern I have is that we get a state like Wisconsin, which may or may not has been called for Biden, but whereby Trump team may be able to call enough ballots into question to put the beyond the margin of victory, whereby potentially the results from, say, a Wisconsin could be thrown out and force a revote. Do you think that scenario is plausible? And it looks like it could be in a handful of states. And I'll get off the line and await your response.
Okay. Matt, recounts are bound to happen in a bunch of these states, aren't they?
Yeah, but usually the recounts are governed by provisions that are already on the book. So in Wisconsin, an election results of a certain turnout that the margin between the two frontrunners is less than 1%. Assuming the protocols are followed, goes to an automatic recount. But as Linda said, you're not re-voting at that time. You're just checking for anomalies in the way the process went. You may, recount, but holding a re-vote is an entirely different thing. That would be unprecedented. I don't think we're going to go there yet.
Today in the program, we're looking at this very tight presidential race. Our number, 1-800-639-2211. If you've got a question or a comment, we would love to hear from you today. Linda, let's look at the Electoral College. We've had a number of people talking about it today. Has the time come to revisit using this as the mechanism for electing a president?
Absolutely. It's an interesting thing in the way my thinking has evolved over the many years I've been teaching. My students always used to ask me about the Electoral College, and I would say, well, you don't really need to think about that. It only mattered in the 19th century before we had well-developed procedures for counting votes and reforms like the Australian ballot and so forth. But I've changed my view on that, in part because we had the Electoral College being the decisive factor in 2000 when Al Gore won the popular vote by about 200,000. Again in 2016 when Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by almost 3 million. And then it looked very much like the Electoral College would be a factor in this election. And in fact, it is. It seems to me that if we're going to have so many elections where the disparity between the Electoral College vote and the popular vote is not just a small thing, but really effectively discounting the votes of 3 or 4 million people. I think that suggests it's time for a change. The problem is that the Electoral College behaves in ways that the framers didn't intend. They thought it as a group of people, men, who were public-minded, who would come together and deliberate when there were ties or there were somebody who was unfit, and they would decide who the best person was. But Thomas Jefferson sort of put the, put that in doubt because he lobbied the Virginia delegation to support him en masse in 1800 in that very close election. And ever since, states have cast their electoral college ballots as winner-take-all races, except for Maine and that one little vote in Nebraska. So it's pretty easy for the kind of winner-take-all problem to distort the race. And that has become even more clear as the disparities in rural and urban states grow. So once the House of Representatives capped the number of lawmakers in the House at 435, it meant that the value of the two Senate seats for small states got increasingly important. So we already have so many biases in the American system, particularly in the Senate, in the non-elected Supreme Court, that tilt political outcomes away from majorities. And to add the Electoral College to that list, I think is really unfortunate.
Ted, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Linda, but I guess I would say yes, but, first of all, the Electoral College is in the Constitution, so you need to have a constitutional amendment. I think we've only had about 27 amendments since the beginning of the country, and 10 of those were the Bill of Rights. You need a two-thirds majority in Congress initially to pass the amendment, and I don't think we can get two-thirds of Congress to agree on what to order for lunch, let alone a constitutional amendment. And then, I'd underscore what Linda just said about the rural vote, right? So here we are in Vermont with 600,000 people, and our three electoral votes represent a disproportionate vote relative to our population. And there's a lot of states that are exactly in the same position. So would you not, I don't want to exaggerate and say disenfranchised, but would you take that voice away from a Vermont and a Montana and a North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, and instead give that vote simply to, giant California and Texas? Would smaller states lose that voice? In this past election, you had Donald Trump going to New Hampshire. People were focused on that one electoral vote in Nebraska because it might come down to that one electoral vote in Nebraska or those votes in Maine. And so would you actually concentrate where people campaign even more into only a half dozen or so of the biggest states? And this would allow candidates to ignore the Vermonts and New Hampshires and Montanas.
Go ahead, Linda.
Can I rebut this? Well,
absolutely.
Both states like Vermont and New Hampshire are already protected in the Senate. Vermont hasn't seen a presidential candidate other than Bernie Sanders in a very long time. So I don't think that's really the issue. There is this principle that's a constitutional principle of one man, one vote, or one person, one vote, which is wildly violated by the Electoral College. But the main thing is, yes, you could say, well, gee, it would be unfair to New Hampshire that Donald Trump wouldn't have come to visit us. But neither Donald Trump nor Joe Biden went to California at all. And that's what the Electoral College just ended up doing.
Matt Dickinson, I have to bring you in on this discussion.
Can I listen to Ted and Linda a little more? I'm still making up my mind. I want to hear Ted's rebuttal. Listen, there is an effort underway to sidestep the constitutional process. It's called the National Popular Vote Plan. And the plan simply says for each state that subscribes, they the legislature agrees to throw their electoral votes to whoever wins the national popular vote. And once you reach 270, assuming it's not litigated, which it will be, you've essentially abolished the Electoral College. Listen, what we're seeing with Ted and Linda here is something I wish we would have nationally. I, too, have seen my views evolve because you have a crisis of legitimacy here. Just the way we rank-and-file people in the country, I have a hard time understanding why the person who gets the most popular votes is not the president. Now, there are good reasons why that is, but you've got to engage in a national debate about this, and I think the outcomes in recent years has pushed an issue that used to be when you had no discrepancy between the popular vote and electoral college vote, nobody really cared about the actual mechanism. Now they care. Now's an opportunity to engage people led by Ted and Linda on both sides. And let's have a conversation. Let's not do this. You know, Vermont is signed on to the National Popular Vote Plan. I don't think anybody in Vermont knows that. Let's not do this by subterfuge. Let's do this with a proper debate about the Electoral College. I think the time is ripe for that.
And Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is one of the reasons that the framers of this country and the founders created an electoral college was they actually didn't trust regular voters to select a president. So instead, the voters would vote for some educated or esteemed people, and then those people would select the president.
That's precisely right. And it's not just that they didn't distrust the people, but they thought most people simply wouldn't be informed. Most Americans never left their small hamlet, you know, Little Ripton in Vermont. They had no idea what was happening in national politics. And so it made perfect sense at the time to entrust that decision to the most informed people. But the argument, again, is times have changed. Our notions of legitimacy have changed, who can participate in politics. But our information technology has changed. People can be more informed. Now, whether they are, I don't know. But yes, the point here is the assumptions built in the framers' reasoning in defending that constitutional idea are increasingly less relevant or at least less accepted today.
Let's turn to John, who is calling from Barrie. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi, Bob. Good morning, Linda and Ted. I know one of you said it was your fun to taking your fun away. I know you said that in irony because this is a very serious situation. It could actually lead to civil unrest. But my question is, sir, as how does the AP determine they're announcing this state goes to the president or to Joe Biden? What measures do they use to allow, you know, to determine that?
John, that's a very good question because we're looking at a situation right now where the Associated Press has called Arizona for Joe Biden. I noticed that the New York Times has not. Anybody on the panel have any idea of the determination that's used by the news operations to make their calls on the outcome of this race?
Go
ahead, Linda.
I think I know a little bit about what's going on in Arizona, which maybe prompted your listener's question. They have statistical models underlying the vote count where they look at the past performance of in terms of party outcomes in various counties, and then they look at where the votes, uncounted votes, are coming from, and they make make judgments in that way. But I think that's the reason why several organizations have not embraced calling Arizona, because there are a lot of absentee ballots coming in, and they use a different model. And they want to see more of what's happening with those absentee ballots in Maricopa County, which is the major county in Arizona. But more specifically than that, I don't know. I think some of this may be proprietary information.
I just jump in, Bob. What one thing that they do, which I think a lot of people aren't aware of, is they have their own polling data. They survey voters online, on the phone, and by mail. And then, as Linda says, they incorporate those returns in conjunction of the votes that are counted on Election Day and the amount of votes outstanding, and they use their own analytical tools. But it's really 50 different calculations because, as Linda pointed out earlier, each state has its own vote counting procedures. So it's a complicated task, but it carries a lot more weight than, because they are the authoritative voice on calling an election, than the regular news media or the broadcast news media's decisions.
Let's talk to Ellen, who's calling from Barrie. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. I'm calling because I have heard the discussion about voter turnout and what some people have called voter apathy over the years. And it always bothers me when we don't take into account the long game that the Republican Party has had to redistrict and suppress votes. And we've seen so much evidence of it, specifically in the past 4 years, especially for communities of color. We saw it just in early voting this past week. We saw it in primaries. And we don't see it in people being removed like they were in Florida from the ballots because their names matched the name of somebody else in another state with very common names. There are so many examples, and I think we do a disservice when we talk about the American public as being apathetic about voting and don't weigh in voter suppression.
Ellen, when you were talking about redistricting, are you saying basically what the way that Congress is set up after every 10-year census, that we see a redistricting of the members of Congress? Is that what you had in mind?
Well, I'm more talking about the gerrymandering aspect of it.
Yeah. Ellen, I mean, I think when the Democrats are in charge, do you see the Democrats doing the gerrymandering as well?
I don't. And that's not everything I've read is not pointed out to that. I believe me, I'm not allied with the Democrats nor the Republicans, mm-hmm. So I have no skin in that game. I don't care. I think there are problems on both sides, and that the people get the shaft often. But yeah, I think that the Republican game has the long game has been to disempower as many voters as possible. And when you have the president saying stop counting votes, these are people who've legitimately voted, are legitimately registered. It just undercuts the entire democracy experiment when you are trying to win by having fewer voters. There's something deeply wrong with this.
Ellen, thanks very much for your phone call. Ted, you've mentioned voter apathy. Your thoughts about Ellen's comments?
No, I think they're well taken. I mean, I think the Republicans were kind of shocked by Barack Obama's win, and they realized that if they focused, you know, you could focus $1 billion on winning a presidential election, but what if you take that same $1 billion and you spread it around state legislative elections? And those are, of course, that's who redraws districts at the state level, you'd get a lot bigger bang for your buck. So there's quite a few books and articles that have been written about this over the past decade about that red long game in order to redistrict. And, you know, I think you could also add to that long game, you know, the fantastic efficacy of Mitch McConnell and the Republicans of, you know, putting the three conservative Supreme Court justices. I mean, this is something Linda talked about being undemocratic as well, you know, just in one term. I mean, this is breaking all land speed records for new Supreme Court justices, as well as, you know, conservative federal judges as well. So even if the Republicans lose the presidency, they have a whole lot of other tools in their toolbox for the next 4 years.
Linda, I'm wondering, one thing we're seeing in a couple of states is something known as ranked choice voting. We saw it in Maine, I believe, for the first time in a presidential election. In Vermont, the city of Burlington used it for a couple of races for mayor. I believe the voters in Massachusetts had a referendum on this item this year, and they did not accept it. They rejected it. Is that something that should be looked at?
I think a lot of political scientists favor different voting systems than the one we have, in part because it's so easy in our system for plurality winners. That is to say, for people who get less than the majority to claim a seat. And so the idea is that what ranked choice voting does is that voters pick their first choice, which is what they do now, but then they also pick their second choice. And if there's another candidate on the ballot, they pick a third choice. And the idea is that if the first choice doesn't win a majority, then you start counting, well, how many people wanted that person as a second choice candidate? What it would do would be to make it more hospitable in the U.S. for third party candidates to be entering elections. And, you know, there are good arguments to be made for and against that idea. But it seems to be to try to force candidates to actually get a majority of the vote rather than win with simply the most votes.
And certainly, Matt, people will look back at the 2000 election and all the votes that were gathered by Ralph Nader in that race and say, you know, if some of those votes had gone to Al Gore, he would have been president.
Or they'll look at 2020 and say the absence of a third-party candidate may have helped Joe Biden. One of the interesting things in 2016 is the presence of third-party candidates, relatively strong ones in Gary Johnson and Bill Weld and Jill Stein, it threw off the forecast models because they just voted in such numbers. But there is some evidence that it may have hurt Hillary Clinton a little bit more than Donald Trump. And if you compare the voting by states, Donald Trump about the 2016 and 2020 votes are very similar. But Joe Biden just kicked up above Clinton's totals. And we think a lot of that is the absence of a strong third-party candidate. You might not have that with ranked voting.
Let's get a quick call in from Bruce in Essex. Hey, Bruce, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. First of all, as a Norwich grad, shout out to Ted, and also to my current mentor, Matt. But I worked on Capitol Hill for about 15 years, and there was a saying largely with our appropriations bills and budget bills, the president proposes, Congress disposes. I want to go to the heart of the matter. Robert Carroll wrote about Lyndon Johnson, the master of the Senate. If he were to write about Mitch McConnell, he might have to talk about the master of the universe. It's going to be fascinating to see how one man with a lot of willing helpers could put so much of Biden's agenda and the House's agenda just in the wastebasket. And I think that is an amazing thing. And, of course, he needs I would call them unindicted co-conspirators, to bring that about in the Senate. But I think this is unbelievable. I've long believed during the Trump presidency the most powerful person in the nation was Mitch McConnell. So I'll get offline and listen to your comments. Thank you very much, all three of you.
Okay, Bruce, thank you very much. Linda, we're almost out of time, but Democrats were very optimistic about taking over the Senate this year. Doesn't look like that's going to happen right now.
Well, if you go back to January, it looked like the Republicans were going to keep the Senate because they had some pretty strong incumbents. It's a function of the COVID virus and the economic dislocation that you began to see people like Lindsey Graham, who ultimately won on Election Day but ended up being in trouble. And so it sort of depends on how you think about the total ticket splitting that seemed to have gone on. I think a lot of suburban women in particular wanted to get rid of Trump above all else, and they voted for Biden. But they still are susceptible to the Republican brand. They still are fiscally conservative, and I think the socialism label and the riots that were happening in some cities in the fall made them a little skeptical. There also were some Senate candidates who were saying Biden's going to win, so you better have a Republican Senate to keep him in check.
Interesting, very discussion there. This has been a wonderful program and discussion about the possible outcome of the 2020 presidential election. Want our listeners to know that we will have breaking news coverage all afternoon from NPR, so stay tuned for that. When it comes, we will definitely have that breaking news coverage. Many thanks to our panel today, Linda Fowler, Ted Cohn, and Matt Dickinson. We really appreciate you taking the time to being on the air and explaining to us how the many directions all of this can go in the coming days, weeks, and months. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks.